Yo, 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 what up? This is For the Culture, where we explore, expose, and celebrate all that is hip-hop. I'm your host, Sarah Rosenberg, a.k.a. Redhead Shade. Before we start, just a disclaimer that For the Culture will include some instances of profanity and talk of sexual assault and abuse. Now that we have that out of the way, let's get this thing popping. Back in the 1970s, hip-hop was not as we know it today, especially in the rough city of Compton, which is just an hour away from here. And in the age of today's rappers just talking smack about the ones who came before, let's take a look back with someone who was actually there and lived through it. As Dr. Dre once said, you're now about to witness the strength of street knowledge. And that being said, let's all welcome hip-hop historian, the godfather of West Coast hip-hop himself, Alonzo Williams. Thank you for coming in.
I'm glad to be here. How y'all doing today, folks? Everybody good?
Yeah, we're good.
Good, good.
Okay, so how did you start DJing?
You know what? I was a kid in Compton, and I used to have dances at the various parks in junior high schools all the time. And I fell in love with DJing then, and that was my first introduction to DJing. But at that time, it was only radio DJs that actually did the DJing in the park dances. And up until then, there was no such thing as a mobile DJ.
Really?
Yeah.
So what made you want to start?
The vibe. When you walk into a room and you got 100 kids dancing in syncopation and you can feel the energy, I just loved it. I just felt it was the best thing in the world. I'm not great at sports. I'm not great at anything, a whole lot of other stuff, but I knew I could do that. And that's what I did. That's why I wanted to become a DJ. I liked feeling that crowd. I'm not a fighter. I'm not a boxer or a football player, basketball player, but the DJ vibe is just as good for me.
Okay, so what was the first time you actually, spin some records?
My first time spinning records was for my car club. I was in a car club that called the Charismatic Vegas. Now, they don't even make Vegas no more. Okay, mm-hmm. Vega was a car made by Chevrolet, and we had a car club. And I used to make, just do those things at my house, DJ parties. I wasn't really DJ, just play at my house. And my buddy said, man, DJ a party for the Charismatic Vegas. And I did. And we made a lot of money. And that made me want to be a DJ and a promoter.
A promoter?
Yes. So I started promoting parties and DJing my own parties.
And what year was this?
That was like 77, 78.
Okay. And so... And you also had a bit of a club, Eve After Dark.
Eve After Dark. At age of 22 years old, my dad helped me cut a deal with one of his friends who owned a banquet hall above his nightclub. And I was at 22. I was able to get my own nightclub, and I was the first DJ to have a residency in his own club. Now, what I'm saying is, it's a lot. I had my own club. It was my club. I was the proprietor and the DJ. So along with being one of the first DJs to have a residency in the club, I also was an owner.
Wow. And how did you pay on that?
That was funny because when I first got it, I had a silent partner that she helped me stay afloat, Miss Jeannie Bilateri. I will always give her credit for supporting me in my early years. And it wasn't until about 5 months after being in business that I was able to get a group to come by and hang out with us, and that was Cameo.
Yeah, we were just talking about that earlier.
Cameo came out to hang out with us, and when they hung out with us, now in fact, I was on a panel this weekend with Larry Blackman up in Sacramento. Larry Blackman did not come to the event, but they sent the horn section, and he didn't know the story even existed. I had told him for the first time, so it's been really a big circle for me to get back around everybody who has been a part of my career.
Oh, that's big. So. And of course, aside from Eve After Dark, you had a couple other business adventures, specifically Crew Cut Records.
Crew Cut Records. When I tell people ask me why am I the godfather of West Coast hip hop, and I have to explain to them when hip hop came to the West Coast, there was not a lot of people waiting on it, and because it was so new, I personally had to wear a lot of hats in order to stake the claim here on the West Coast for hip-hop. I was a club owner, a DJ, and then I became a record label owner. And then I formed the group World Class Wrecking Crew. And later I formed a company called West Coast Record Distributors. And I brought in Run DMC as a promoter and LL Cool J as a promoter and Curtis Blow as a promoter. So when you're trying to make your way in a new territory, you got to wear various hats. And that's kind of how I got things going.
So you basically was doing this all on your own?
All on my own. The Eve After Dark gave me enough of a cash flow to allow me to experiment whatever I wanted to do. I tell people all the time, I was a kid with ADHD with a little bit of money. So whatever I thought about I wanted to do, I had the money to do it. I had the money to fund it. Didn't have a lot of money. Didn't finish a lot of it, but most of the time I got to start it.
Okay, and of course, Eve After Dark is a little more famous for introducing Dr. Dre.
Dr. Dre came out of Eve After Dark. I met him and Eazy-E on the steps of Eve After Dark when I was starting to promote Curtis Blow and Run DMC. And Dre, I gave him his first DJ job, his first regular job as a DJ.
Yeah, you were actually a play earlier in the role of Straight Outta Compton, which is the Oscar-nominated film.
Right.
But they don't really spend a lot of time on the World Class Wrecking Crew.
No, in fact, in the movie Straight Outta Compton, which I thought was kind of not that great, they kind of dissed us a little bit. You know, they act like the World Class Wrecking Crew did not like wearing their jackets. And the truth behind that is, if you had a jacket, one of those purple jackets back in the day, you were a local god because you could not buy them. And maybe for me now, that may have been a marketing mistake, but at that time, that was the general consensus for all those type of jackets. You have to understand that the reason why we had those jackets is because all record companies had satin jackets. If you worked for Casablanca, they had a Casablanca jacket, a Motown jacket, whoever. Everybody had their own jackets. And I found out through a buddy of mine where they made those jackets at, had ours made. And just like the record companies, you couldn't buy a record company jacket. So you couldn't buy a record crew jacket. Now I'd mass produce them something terrible. They'd be at the swap meet. But it's too late for that.
So no jackets available right now?
Nah. You know what? The more I think about it, the more it may become a limited edition item. I'm very serious about that.
Wow. So it might be like something you can see on eBay.
It might be something you can see on eBay, yes.
That's pretty cool. So tell us how World Class Wrecking Crew kind of came to be.
World Class Wrecking Crew came to be just on the fact that I had a nightclub, and most of the guys that came and became a part of World Class Wrecking Crew started off being his clientele or just patrons of Eve After Dark. I met DJ Yella. DJ Yella originally came to me as a poster snatcher.
Poster snatcher,
because you have to understand, back then, we didn't have social media. We didn't have the glossy flyers like you guys have now, and we had to hang up posters. It was a physical job to go out on Wednesday night to hang out posters all over the city, and that was our main source of advertising. And if you snatched those posters down or covered those posters up, it was a problem. So me, being that I had a few dollars, I would hire poster snatchers, because what happened is people would come out behind you with open house posters or cars for sale or whatever the case may be, and they would cover up the poster. Okay. So I hired Yella, gave him a bounty of 25 cents per poster to bring me back all the posters that was covering up my posters, plus any other dance promoters in our area. So it was kind of we were very territorial with our promotions. And it made for a interesting situation. That was his introduction. Clientele, I met him he won a contest I gave at Eve After Dark. He was such a great rapper, so articulate, excellent lyrics. And I brought him in. And then Dr. Dre came in. He was the last one to come in. And when he came in, under a very unique situation, because he came in, I let him in the club after I denied him entry twice.
Why?
And then he ended up on the turntables, and how he did, I don't know to this day how he got on my turntables, because I would not let anybody on my turntables. I believe Unknown may have let him do that, but nonetheless, that's how they all came together.
And it was described in the defined ones as like a teen club.
It was a teen club. We didn't sell alcohol. We had no alcohol whatsoever. We had a few security guards, and because the owner of the club was very strict with the with the drug, with no drugs in the club, I had a couple of security guards that worked undercover just to bust potential drug dealers.
So you were also working with the law?
Yeah, but it worked out against me, though, because they got tired of me calling so much. And then this one cop, he just decided that he did not like me.
Wow.
And he gave me all kind of hassles. Unfortunately, because I lived in the same area in which the club was, he knew where I lived at, so he would harass me all during the week. And it didn't help that most of the guys in my neighborhood sold other type of drugs, and I was the only one that didn't sell drugs, but I looked like I may have sold drugs. Yeah, it was one of those eras where everybody kind of looked alike.
Looked alike?
Yes. We all had Jerry curls. We all had nice suits. Back then, all the street guys, we didn't wear tennis shoes back then. You know, we wore suits and slacks every day.
Suits and slacks? That doesn't sound very hip-hop.
Yeah, well, no, it was kind of, West Coast has always been kind of unique when it came to that era. I mean, even when we first started in hip-hop, even after dark, we had a very strict dress code. You couldn't wear tennis shoes even after dark.
Okay, and you were talking about a little bit of the police, how it kind of worked against you. There is a very famous song by N.W.A., which has your former Wrecking Crew members,
right.
Dr. Dre and Eazy-E. By the way, the anniversary of Eazy-E's death is tomorrow.
Wow,
so
that's
rest
right.
In peace.
What, 26 years?
Yeah.
Wow.
He died from AIDS 26 years ago tomorrow.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, very sad. You actually talk about an interview about what inspired the song. And for the viewers at home, trigger warning, title has the curse, has cursing in it. So,
My bad.
It's fine. It's cursing in it. The song is called Fuck the Police. You said an interview.
She said it, I didn't.
Hey, it's a curse word. This is a cause of realization, but still, we're human. So can you tell us about that story? You told it a little bit in an interview.
You know, When I first heard that song, the scenario in which I first heard them use that phrase was totally different from what people may have thought it to be. At one point in time, we all were big paintball fans, Dre, Yella, and myself, and Arabian Prince, L.A. Dream Team, Bobby Jimmy and the Critters. We all go out to Malibu and shoot paintball every weekend, and Eazy-E always wanted to go, but he never went. He bought a paintball shotgun, and he always carried this thing with him. And one day, they decided that shooting their cars going down the Harbor Freeway was a good idea. And by doing this, they didn't realize that the off-ramp in which they were going was right next to the Highway Patrol office in Torrance. And they got jammed by the cops like nobody's business. If it had been today, they'd all been dead. And they came back to my house virtually crying and complaining, F the police, I'm tired of boo, 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 boo. And that was the first time I experienced them that mad at the police. Now, it may have been another situation that actually spurred them writing the song, but that was my first experience with them actually having an issue with the police.
And, of course, today it's kind of like an anthem against police brutality with everything that's going on right now.
Yeah, much has not changed since then. That's the sad part about it. That was 25, 30 years ago, and we're still dealing with the same issues right now.
Yeah, another thing that happened 30 years ago that you talked about, you actually, today, you have your own YouTube channel.
Yes, I have my own YouTube channel. You can follow me, Real Lonzo NWA or Lonzo Williams, and you'll hear a lot of these stories in depth on my YouTube channel.
Yeah. Yeah, and back to what happened 30 years ago thing, not only police brutality is kind of still around.
Right.
But you said something about about sexual predators, specifically child predators in the music industry. This is actually a quote from the video. Again, trigger warning for everybody at home. This quote, "The R. Kelly thing ain't nothing new. None of this is new. When he was having a sexual relationship with Aaliyah, everybody knew it. Her mama knew it. Everybody saw this. But they turned a blind eye because it was R. Kelly. What happened, I think, to a lot of people, whether it be Michael Jackson or R. Kelly, whatever the case may be, people around you don't want to lose access to you. So they'll turn a blind eye, even if it means your detriment. That's what happens when people get surrounded by people who are more interested in the money, the access of being close to you. They'll turn a blind eye to whatever you do." these people are not your friends. They'll let you do whatever you want as long as they get what they want. Now that this is new, it's 30 years old, and it's like they have a new resurgence of old stuff to bring down mostly black people. Do you really think that this is a race thing?
Well, I have to say, it may not be a race thing per se, but they're going after the brothers first, and I have not seen the same type of persistence when it comes to a lot of the other people who've done some of the same things. I mean, it's no secret that Elvis married Priscilla when she was 14. It's no secret that Jerry Lee Lewis had a 13 or 14-year-old cousin he married. It's no secret that a lot of these celebrities have done some of the same things, but it seems like our celebrities are going down harder and faster than anybody else. Brooke Shields was posing in Playboy, and she was like 12 or 13. Hugh Hefner did the same thing that R. Kelly, he had his own group of women and hung in his house on a regular basis. It was never considered a harem, and it was never never investigation, and it was a known fact that there were some women that were there that may have been underage. And for Michael to be gone as long as he has, and still they're trying to sue and cause problems for him after all this time, come on. I ain't heard nothing about Harvey Weinstein in a while. It's been very quiet. So it may not be a black thing, but it sure looks like one.
I mean, Harvey's now in jail.
Is he? Thought he got bail.
He's now also under investigation and right now on trial for the rape and sexual abuse of multiple women.
Okay, now he's out. He's in jail or he's out on bail.
He's out on bail, but he's going through the trial.
Okay,
but only because of the trial.
Okay, it's not on my news feed. Put it that way. It's not on my news feed like R. Kelly is. That's all.
Yeah, and of course R. Kelly recently did get arrested.
Right, again. Okay, so he has his own issues. I mean, it's just really, I think probably, R. Kelly situation, if you throw enough rocks at a beehive, you're going to get stung, okay? He's gotten away a couple of times with different situations, and he just refused to let that go. I'm not saying the man is guilty, but doggone sure looks that way.
It's fine. Okay, and of course, aside from the R. Kelly thing, this is in the Michael Jackson stories.
That one right there, the Michael Jackson story, these guys are, 28 years old? Michael been dead for about, nine, 10 years? And they're going after the estate? And when these cases were pretty much dismissed at one time, weren't they? So it's a new whole, it's a reactivating something that's kind of old. He's not here to defend himself. So it's really,
I mean, that's all they could do, legally.
Well, I thought he was already acquitted, right?
Of a different one.
Okay.
Of a different case. It was a different case.
It took a long time. It took a long time for them to get back to him. That's the part. Why now?
I'm not going to give my opinion on this.
Okay. All right. No problem.
Okay. Aside from that, there is many stories, specifically in hip-hop throughout history. I mean, there's many icons that have been accused, arrested, and even convicted of sexual assault. Tupac was convicted of sexual assault. And Tekashi 6ix9ine. If people don't know the story, trigger warning right here. So, and you actually did your own video on the Tekashi 6ix9ine. Thing in his arrest.
Right.
And for people who don't know about this, a trigger warning, here's the story. Tekashi 6ix9ine, he's a rapper. I cannot find a single photo of him where he doesn't look like a horror movie. He sexually assaulted a 13-year-old girl and posted videos of the assault on Instagram. He pled guilty, got 4 years probation, did not include having to register as a sex offender, even though that's the minimum in most cases,
right,
of child sexual abuse. Last May, he got busted for beating up a police officer. Then last October, he was arrested again for racketeering and weapons charges, and that's where most of the community kind of turned their backs, was the racketeering. As of today, he's still locked in jail in New York, facing 32 years to life in prison, and his girlfriend and mother of his child accused him of domestic violence. And you technically didn't actually specifically talk about that case on the video. You mostly talked about your late friend Billy T.
Right.
So why did you want to make that video?
I think it's necessary because artists have to see It seems like there's a generation of artists that seem they have to retroactively get street credibility to make themselves more viable. Tekashi 69 and like so many other artists try to do things to make themselves seem a lot tougher than they really are. All the tattoos, all the gang members, gang associations will not change your natural heart. If if you don't have it in you as a gangster for real, you can't buy that association. If you don't have the heart or the mentality, you can't buy that association. And it seems like these guys are trying to buy their way into a certain credibility that's not really necessary if you have good music. And that's the part that I find difficult to swallow as a veteran in the game. Your music should speak for itself. Your gang affiliations are not what you are. They're just, most people will actually make money to leave gangs, but nowadays artists seem to make money to join gangs. And I find it very confusing.
I find it disturbing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and of course, other news in hip hop, no. There's just a bunch of sexual assault. I mean, and of course, Dr. Dre even admitted to doing this himself during his time in the World Class Wrecking Crew.
Oh, no. That was after. That was Ruthless days. That wasn't Wrecking Crew days. I have never seen Dre hit or abuse a woman at World Class Wrecking Crew. Anything that may have taken place at that time, it probably was after Ruthless. I never seen Dre drink. Nobody in the World Class Wrecking Crew or Crew Cut Records drink or smoke. It was not there. That was not our mentality. That was not our get down. So anything that happened after that, that was after World Class Wrecking Crew.
But he did admit to it.
Huh?
He did admit that during his early years, he did some stuff that may today, looking back.
If I go back in my closet, I have some things in my closet that may look like something different. That's one of the problems I find in dealing with a lot of these issues. A lot of things that were acceptable at one point in time, how do we go back 25, 30 years and punish somebody for something that was almost acceptable at one point in time? It's kind of confusing for me.
I get it, but isn't sexual abuse not good?
It's never good. But if it's over with, I mean, you know, sometimes you have an apology and going to jail for something that happened 30 years ago or being having to deal with it again. If everybody's kind of not really got over it, but, you know, moved on, is it going to make it any better to have to relive it again 30 years ago?
Okay, and are you still in contact with any of the World Class Wrecking Crew members today?
All the time. Talked to Clientele yesterday. Saw Yella about 2 weeks ago. Don't talk to Dre that much. Oh. He's kind of busy.
Being a billionaire.
He's kind of busy counting money these days.
I just saw on Instagram, his daughter got into USC.
Right. I heard about that yesterday. Yeah. Interesting.
He's not going to jail for that.
No.
Okay. And, of course, two more things. You have a book called I'm Not Without Alonzo.
NWA, Not Without Alonzo. It don't happen.
And that was released the same year as Straight Outta Compton, and you were also interviewed for the HBO documentary, The Defiant Ones.
Yes.
How do you feel you were betrayed in both films, and why did you want to write that book?
I knew for a fact. First of all, I didn't think I was going to be in Straight Outta Compton. I had no indication. Nobody informed me. In fact, I didn't find out I was in Straight Outta Compton until they started shooting.
Really?
A buddy of mine who was an extra on the set called me and told me, hey, man, there's a guy playing you in this movie. Right, man, bull. No, seriously, there's a guy playing you in the movie. And I went down to the set and talked to the guy, Corey Reynolds, and we had a chance to talk. I gave him some Lonzo lessons. Some Lonzo lessons. I taught him how to cuss real well. And it worked out well for him. Initially, I was surprised that they portrayed me in Straight Outta Compton as the mean guy because I took care of everybody. I was like everybody's big brother, uncle, dad, whatever the case may be. But I also later realized that I was fortunate to be in the movie because it was a lot of people that were very significant in the development of NWA that were not in the movie, like Arabian Prince, J.J. Fad, Michelle A. And I was just glad that my participation in their careers was not overlooked through the movie.
Okay, and last question. You were known as the godfather of West Coast hip hop. Is it weird having such a big part of music history?
You know what? Yes, it is now, but as I was doing what I was doing, I just did what I did. It was nothing that, you know, nobody ever wakes up in the morning and said, we're gonna make history today. We just start doing what we do, and, you know, we need a DJ, we need a club, we need this. You do what you do.
Okay, thanks for everybody tuning in. We'll be off next week for spring break, and we'll be back on April 8th with hip-hop blogger Baby Bella C. Until then, this is Reddit Shoddy signing out.
Peace!